Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Thank you for listening to Spin, the Rally Pod, brought to you by Dirtfish Rally School. For your chance to experience life behind the wheel of a rally car, head to drive.dirtfish.com to find the course that's right for you. What are you waiting for? We're right here waiting for you.
Welcome to another scintillating edition of Spin, the Rally Pod. I'm David Evans, and I have with me the fabulous pairing of former sporting director George Donaldson and what are you now, James? We changed your job title, didn't we? You're now Rally's editor. Is that right?
Is that right? Okay, I'll take it if you're offering it, David. Thank you very much.
No, I think we discussed that before Christmas. It's been a very busy time here at Dirtfish, and obviously things have been changing. We've got a new head of content in now. Very excited to have Alistair Lindsay back with us. Everybody will be meeting Alistair starting on the pod next week. Sorry, perhaps we didn't formalise that. Well, let's consider that formalised. Welcome to our new Rally's editor, James Bowen.
Sorry. Hello, James. David.
And what we're going to talk about this week is very, very exciting because the season is up and running. We are recording on Friday because we have a super busy Monday, Tuesday where we can't manage to fit the pod recording in early next week. The season, by the time you're listening to this, the season will have begun because obviously Yana Rally is this weekend. Great story from Alistair on there on dirtfish.com. Tune in. Don't tune in, but have a read of that. It's a fascinating tale. But the season has started. Colin, we're going to hear from Colin later. Colin is out in Saudi Arabia for Dakar. But really, for hardcore WRC fans, the season starts with Monte Carlo testing. And in some ways, this is one of the quirks of our sport, is that the season usually starts almost before the year is finished, because ordinarily we would have seen cars in the Alps last year in December doing some pre-Christmas running. But the new testing regulations are very, very tight. They only offer 1 day per driver per event. So there's no scope for going and doing a week's running in the Alps just to feel the car setup and what have you. But the reason, one of the main reasons that George is here, George is always here, George is very, very welcome, he's a fabulous voice, but one of the points here, George, is to basically for you to tell us more about what your memories were from actually testing in Monte. Firstly, when was your first Monte test? What was your first memory?
My first Monte test must have been 1989, which was the first year for TTE. Was it, or was it 88?
88.
When did we start?
I think it was 88, wasn't it?
No, was it Monte Carlo 88? Carlos Sainz, is that correct? He went off on what was the name of the stage? Just down there below Gap, actually. I can get that name in a second.
It wasn't Sisteron.
It was Sisteron. It was actually. Of course, it was Sisteron. Yeah. But the rally started. The rally started for us in. For me, it started up in Germany. Absolutely amazing. And we ran the road section. You know, the what did they call it? The concentration run.
Yeah.
Right.
And that was amazing. And you had no idea when a car was going to arrive. You just parked in the right place with a big Toyota van and a rally car arrived with you. You filled it up with fuel, gave the drivers a cup of coffee if they wanted it, and they continued on their way.
Where would that have been?
Rally cars weren't warm.
Was it Berlin or Munich or?
No, it was down near Munich somewhere. Somewhere between Cologne and Munich. I'm just trying to remember the name of the
place.
There
was Bad Homburg. Was it Bad Homburg?
Bad Homburg. Bad Homburg. Thank you, David. Bad Homburg is exactly where it was.
I've got to say, George, I never knew where that place was, but I only remember because the cars always ran with their concentration run start point.
That's correct.
On the door plate, didn't they? And I always remember
a big door plate,
seeing that and thinking, I wonder where that is. So now we know.
Yeah,
so
Bad Homburg. It was down south of... Was it Saarbrücken somewhere down there? I'm not quite sure where Bad Homburg. I apologise to all those people from Bad Homburg, but I remember it was quite snowy to get there. It was quite a trick to be in the right place. But then it all cleared.
So I remember
going to scrutineering.
But what was it like, George? Did you scrutineer in Bad Homburg, or was it?
Yes.
I mean, that's...
Scrutineering was just done by German scrutineers. No FIA presence at all. I think the FIA scrutineer was probably in Italy, making sure that the Lancias were being allowed to do what they wanted.
Excellent.
Contentious stuff.
But what did it mean, George? I mean, was there a huge start ramp? And then was there a prescribed route down to Monaco?
I think it was somewhere in the town centre. I remember we were in a hotel and the start was very close to that. And it was kind of almost like a club rally affair more than anything else, but quite a lot of people there. And it was a lovely atmosphere, but of course the feeling was that you just wanted to get on with it and get driving, because there was no... It was just a section that you had to drive. There were a few passage controls, lots of passage controls, where you had to go into particular towns, and the towns would have a little ramp set up, and you would get a signature on some sort of time card to say you were there, and then you went on your way.
Strict timing. You weren't.
No.
I remember being
down. In fact, where we crossed the border into, we were at Trier. I was my first. So I'd done Bad Homburg start. And the cars had to go away and do a loop somewhere. So I don't think I stayed for the start, but I remember being at Trier, and the cars came about an hour earlier than we expected. We were kipping in the van when they arrived.
And it was the crew, the actual start crew, that drove the cars. You know, you couldn't have engineers or mechanics.
It was Carlos and Lewis, Bjorn and Fred, and I can't remember who the third car was actually. Who was the third car?
One of the Ericssons, would it?
Kenneth Ericsson. It would have been exactly Kenneth Ericsson.
Yeah. So I've got, just to clear up a point from earlier, I did a little bit of Googling, and the Celica did start, of course, in 88, but it ran a part season, started in Safari. So first full year was 89. So you were right,
yes,
first time.
Right.
Monty, 89. Would you have gone out there in 88 just to have a look, to be aware of the event or to do any preparation? Or
Myself, I hadn't done the recce on that one. I think I was probably still looking after... I'd have been involved in Kenya stuff.
Yeah.
So we'd have still been doing Kenya with the Turbo Supra at that point. Yeah, Turbo Supra we had used.
Which?
So we'd have been doing preparation for that, so I was probably out for that. I don't remember much of the pre-stuff, except I remember arriving in Cologne, jumping in a van with Pat O'Sullivan, and then off we went, and it was quite a few hours until we saw a hotel. I think we had the night in Bad Homburg, but then the next day, whether we were, I can't remember hanging around, but I remember driving all the way down, and we all met up in, well, the rally congregated at that year in, is it Saint-Étienne or something? Would it be that? Am I right saying that? Apologies for
I think you're right,
David. So it's just south of Dijon, up there. I think. Well, it was either Valence or up. Up that, was it Saint-Étienne?
I think James was about to jump in there with some geographical insight.
James, jump in. Sort me out.
Yeah.
Sort me
you're,
out,
you're right, George. It was Saint-Étienne, and then the first few stages were up that way.
I think it was, and then, but our congregation point was Sisteron. And then, of course, that first day through the Ardèche, absolutely amazing. You know, just the most amazing stages up there. The names. I temporarily can't remember the names here. I'm obviously just getting demented now, my old age. So much information in there.
But
I've just come off the back of a very, very hectic day of work, I have to say.
Sorry, just to clear up, George, Bad Homburg, I've again done a little bit of Googling, a bit of research. Just north of Frankfurt. And then Trier is out to the west of there. But how bizarre that you would have stopped in Trier.
Yeah.
All those years ahead of Germany actually hosting a WRC round in Trier.
And I remember we were on the main street into Trier and just parked in between trees.
By the Black Gate?
Making sure we were visible. I'm not quite sure where it was now. Right next to the river, on the south side of the river, anyway.
Yeah.
Not on the motorway. And the cars didn't use the motorways. They had to use the wee roads. You know,
right?
So it was just drive, and it was 1,000 kilometers. So they didn't, you know, it's not 1,000 kilometers from Bad Homburg to Saint-Étienne. It's probably only about maybe 500 or 600, maybe 700. So you know, there's a lot looping around. So they did a loop in Germany, because, like I said, they arrived with us way maybe an hour and 90 minutes before we expected them, and then our next point was somewhere down. Somewhere north of Lyon, somewhere, yeah. some little place quite far off the road, and I remember we got to that thinking, well, we got there about maybe an 2 hours, maybe 3 hours before we should have got there, and the cars were with us again an hour and a half, 2 hours early.
It's one heck of a way to wake up, isn't it, when you're having a snooze in the back of the van, to have Mr. Carlos Sainz arriving in a factory site.
They were cool. They were cool about it, but you can imagine the panicked look of terror and all the on all us mechanics' faces. You know, you do not. The last thing you ever do is keep drivers waiting. But in reality, that was an unstressed situation. So it's a great shakedown for the cars. You know, a 1,000 kilometers on the road is brilliant, and if a rally car can't do that, then quite frankly, you know, it's not fit for purpose.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine
those events anyway. That was for sure,
George. If they reintroduce that today, I'm just trying to imagine what Sebastian Ogier would have to say about a 1,000 kilometre road section before the rally even started. I don't think he'd be particularly pleased.
They would have. They're so much more highly paid now that they shouldn't be expected to do work. So, sorry, Seb. I hope he doesn't listen to this, because of course he does. Seb, I'm really sorry. That wasn't a personal slight. It was just a sort of joke. It was take it lightly.
It just, James, I mean, you just couldn't imagine it now, could you? I mean, the furore that was caused by the Central European Rally route. And the fact that you know we're all about sustainability, James, it just wouldn't happen, would it?
Yeah, I couldn't imagine it happening, David. Quite frankly, although when did they stop doing it on the Monty? Can't have been too long after.
Can't remember the year it stopped. It was quite late on. I remember still doing it in 1995.
Oh, right.
I can't remember doing it in 1996, 1997, 1998, 1999. 96 Monte Carlo I didn't do, because that was the banned year from Toyota and we didn't send anybody to that. First rally we did that year was Sweden. So 97.
That was your year on a naughty step.
Yeah, and I think 97, I think we didn't bother doing it because we weren't doing a full championship year. So it was probably 98. So I think it was gone between 95 and 98. I'm pretty sure, did we... We might have done it in 98, because I remember...
No, you did do it in 98.
No, I was going to say, I remember Didier. We used to always start Didier down in France. We'd start Juha up in Germany. And I remember one year actually starting... Well, that was at 98. I started in Turin with Juha. Didier started down in France, wherever it was they started from in France, or was it maybe Madrid? Maybe he went to Madrid, or Barcelona, and at that time it was Armin Schwartz, and he started from Bad Homburg. Yeah, so
Madrid.
So
I mean,
still
that's
there in 95.
But I was just going to say Madrid's a bit of a trek, but I have a recollection that they obviously started in Glasgow. We know that. But they also started from Lisbon. I mean, they started from Russia, didn't they? I remember talking to Paddy Hopkirk.
John O'Groats.
But they started from Moscow. Because I remember one year, talking to Paddy Hopkirk about starting the Monte Carlo from Moscow in, I don't know what it would have been, mid-60s or something. And just the absolute terror of driving through the USSR across all of the border checkpoints. And Paddy told me a great story about when they were stopped at one point, and he said the army always arrived with their guns and everything, and he said they would open the door and you'd get out, and he said we had a big coat across the back seat, and obviously there was no English spoken, no Russian spoken, so very difficult to communicate. And the guy was sort of pointing his gun at the coat, obviously expecting there to be a body or something under there. Paddy was like, no, it's a tire, it's a spare tire. And the soldier put his hand under the coat, and it was the spikes, and he cut his fingers on the spike which didn't go down well. I mean, that's
chocolate required to remedy that.
Chocolate or cigarettes, I would imagine, yeah. But that surely is the furthest. I mean, Moscow to Monaco is a big old trek, isn't it?
Interesting geographical fact coming up. Moscow's on the same latitude as Edinburgh and Glasgow. There you go.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
There you go. You didn't realise that. It's a heck of a long way east.
it is. So let's fast forward to 89 then. And George, what testing, preparing Toyota for its first Monte Carlo rally, what was that like?
Well, as I said, I don't know if I was terribly much involved in that first one. I can't really recall. I suspect I was in Kenya.
Sorry, but, you did say that. Fast forwarding to 1990.
I 1990... 89, 90, I think it was. I did the full recce stroke test with Armin Schwartz that year, and that was a tough year with Armin. So we started off with him on day one. We'd come down with a rally car on a trailer. He arrived with a hire car. I can't remember exactly where we met. It was probably in Valence, and we started off in the Ardèche. And I do remember that first day, about 6 o'clock in the evening, Armin saying to us, when can we recce till? When can we stop? And we said, well, look, we can go as long as we'd like to have dinner at a reasonable hour before dinner's not available. So there was a bit of a discussion about that. And we were up there in the Ardèche. We found this lovely little restaurant. I remember having the most amazing dinner in there with Armin. When we came out, it was blowing a blizzard, and we're sort of thinking, well, that's the recce finish. But no, Armin wanted to go and do Saint-Bonnet-le-Froid, blowing a blizzard, and he proceeded to continue. So we came out from dinner maybe at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and we got back to the hotel about 4 o'clock in the morning for a 7 o'clock start the next day in a rally car to re-prepare.
All rallying, one source. By now, you know that Dirtfish.com is the place to go for all of your rallying news. But when it's time to try your hand behind the wheel, just join us here at Dirtfish Rally School, nestled in the Cascade Mountains in Snoqualmie, Washington. Whether you're a pro seeking extra seat time or a novice looking to get started, we've got programs tailored to all rallying needs. And when you want to watch the best in the world, just head over to our YouTube channel. Our coverage of the WRC and American rallying is second to none. Follow us at Dirtfish Rally across all social media platforms and shop the latest looks in our merchandise store now. As always, rally on.
It was always worth getting out and wrecking when the snow came, the blizzards came, because quite possibly it was going to be the same as the conditions you get on the event. And that does...
An element of that, yes.
Absolutely. It doesn't change the way you write your notes, but it brings a certain perspective, doesn't it?
Totally does. I mean, that recce I did with Pat O'Sullivan, basically we decided we wouldn't be defeated by Armin, and Armin was looking to drive, 18 to 20 hours a day, and then we had to work on the car on top of that, including a few breakdowns and recover the car from calls, etc. and all the time we were pulling a trailer with his hire car on it because we were basically moving hotel every night. So it was quite a deal. We must have gone round the route three times. We were up and down to Monaco three times that year, backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. Armin would have done, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 passes on each stage. We were there for, it must have been 3.5 weeks.
Wow. That's incredible,
isn't
it? And
we were doing 18, we were filling up, we must have had maybe 300 litres of fuel in cans. And then we had a 200 litre fuel tank in the van, which we regularly pulled out of to keep the rally car going. And a mildly detuned engine. It was a Group A car. It was a B-spec engine. It was probably down about 30 or 40 horsepower from the real thing. And we ran on race tyres.
Seriously? So if the sun came out, you were put on slicks?
Yep. Absolutely all tolerated and all accepted.
But still open road recce, though.
It was absolutely open road recce. Later on, a few years later, when Armin was in the team again, with the later marks of Celicas, Didier and Juha, they'd quite often recce together. Well, even that year, I even remember, it must have been 1991, I remember wrecking together with Carlos. It was Carlos and Armin, and that was the first year that Group A recce was not allowed, but you could still test during the recce. So we had test cars with us, so we had recce cars and test cars.
Oh my goodness.
So they would recce all day and then they would go and test, and there was no limit where you could test, I think. But I remember we'd only take the test cars out at night. But let me know, like, you know, and you know, if you know, we didn't start doing it, but we saw everyone else doing it, so then of course our drivers just followed suit. Yeah. You know, there's Marco out driving a Lancia Delta Integrale at night over the stages. Okay, fine. Everyone knew what was being done, and that was what was done. It was absolutely the norm. It was a different time regarding regulations, etc.
Yeah.
So it's just how it was. So it certainly wasn't cheating. It was taking advantage of slack regulations, yes. Repercussion free, yes. Everybody was doing it. You know, Mazda were doing it, Lancia were doing it, Ford were doing it, everyone was doing it.
But I remember that the, what would it, obviously it would have been the 86 Monte, when, I don't remember it at the time, but the stories about Toivonen coming in, I think it was Toivonen and Salonen were fighting for the lead, and Toivonen came into Monaco, obviously for the Altmara team stages over Torini and that kind of stuff. They all came back into Monaco quite late. Everybody went off to bed ahead of the final leg, and he went into the stages. He got into the recce car and went in the middle of the rally and went and did another recce. Yep. I mean, the commitment there is enormous, but it's another world from what we have today, isn't it?
It is absolutely another world. And I mean, that was normal. I remember Bjorn Waldegard sharing a story when I was young and wide-eyed, telling us about his first Monte Carlo rally with Porsche.
Yeah.
And when he arrived in Monte Carlo during the rally, he back to the hotel, and a mechanic came and found him and said, this is the key to your car, Mr. Waldegard. He said, what car is that? Your recce car, to go and check the stages for tonight. So they'd obviously arrived in overnight in the morning. You then got a day off and you went off up into the hills at night. And Bjorn jumped into his Porsche 911. And I don't know who was navigating for him. It might have been Hans Terselius, probably still at that point. Off they went into the mountains and tested. Wrecked, as it were.
It is just remarkable to see how far we've come, and
less cars on the road. That was in the late 60s, I guess, when Bjorn did that. Oh. And I remember him saying that all the drivers of the time ridiculing him, saying, "Yeah, well, you know, your first Monte Carlo, young Swede. You're here to learn. Don't worry. You watch us. You'll be surprised at the pace. But you know, if you stick at it, you might catch us." And I think, did Bjorn win that event? I think he won his first Monte Carlo in a Porsche.
Yeah,
you'd have to look that one up. Get onto our favourite website, David. I'm just giving you. I'm fired. You've given me work to do. I'm firing it straight back at you. I apologise.
Not at all. Yeah. I think so. But one of the
so it was still going on. That was still going on in the from the mid 90s until basically the mid 90s. That's the way it was done. And you were still doing, you know, 3 or 4 week recces, but of course it was only an eight event championship at that time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, so that was the difference. Although I don't think 12 events is not that much more. And this desperation of drivers not to be in the country, I find a little bit galling. I'm galled by that. I don't begrudge them what they do at all. I don't begrudge them what their opinion is. Totally respect that. But they arrive in the country, they immediately start wrecking. They might get a day's test just prior to the recce, or they might have come in a few days before. Then they go home for 2 or 3 days. Then they come back. They don't hit the local restaurants anymore. They don't know all the nice spots. When the rally finishes, they can't wait to get back to their private jets or whatever airline they're getting on to get the heck out of Dodge before the event has even, you know, before the dust has even settled on the event. There's a big loss, and that loss comes from the drivers and the teams. That's not the events. That's not any other circumstance. I mean, are they working more than those guys used to? Well, I mean, Armin, we would have done 8 rallies, you were probably the better part between the testing you did and the rallies. I'll bet you were eight and a half months on the road for a driver back in the mid to late 80s, early 90s.
I guess
you'd go
so.
Down
I mean,
to New Zealand, same thing. You'd go down for a test. You would hang around and wait for the recce to be starting. If it was a 2 week recce, you did the full two weeks. If it was a 3 week recce, you'd be there for 3 weeks. You would just do as much as you could. There was no limited number of passes. You decided what you were going to do within the time scale.
The thing about rallying back then as well is all of that was quite visible, wasn't it, George? Because people would go and watch testing and people would see that what the drivers were up to. Now we don't see really how the drivers are prepping for events. You know, we're not seeing them in the hotel rooms watching videos.
The whole thing was a celebrated event, basically, and it was brilliant. You know, if we speak to some of our older listeners, they'll tell you about their experiences, you know, following the event as it hit the country and you know, managing to strike up conversations with mechanics and teams, many of them ending up with jobs in teams, of course. Which is basically how most pros became pros. They were keen amateurs, got a contact with a team. Somebody saw the virtue in what they were as contributors, and they ended up working for a team. How many Kiwis and Australians, Finns? You know, there was no factory rally teams in Finns, but Toyota was filled with Finns. You know, well, not filled with Finns, but we had 4 or 5 fantastic mechanics, Swedish mechanics. It's all down to, you know, people just interfacing and contacting and, okay, a little bit of who you know for sure, but that's just a matter of cultivating the opportunity.
Fantastic.
And that's what people did. You know, I remember in Portugal going to restaurants and you'd see the same people every night in the same restaurant that you're in. You're thinking, that's a bit strange. That person's... And they were just there. They were people watching. They were watching the drivers eat or the teams eat or whatever. And it was lovely. And, you know, you would speak to them and it was nice and friendly. So that I feel that's a massive loss for drivers. You know, perhaps that's why, you know, Kalle Rovanperä is so jaded and that he feels he needs to stop, because actually it's just a little machine. You know, he eats in the, so he arrives in the country, he immediately starts wrecking. He gets back from his day's recce, he goes into the hotel, his co-driver prepares the pace notes. Half an hour later they're in the room looking at videos, which I totally respect that. Not decrying that at all. That's a fabulous, the refinement in the pace notes now is immense.
Probably not quite as fun as being out testing or wrecking as much as you want, though, is it?
Categorically, I think so. If you allowed 3 weeks recce, they would do their 3 weeks recce. Their pace notes would be amazing, but still, every night they would be in. They would now be doing video yeah. checking, yeah, which is a great tool. I'm always surprised that that's not stepped up a gear. I would suggest that video recce, brilliant, but you need a perspective to catch it, and the perspective you get from doing multiple passes of the stage. So how could you get that with video? It's pretty obvious to me. 3D video, which would not be hard. It exists, so why would you not do it? And then you do a bit hard for the co-driver to write and correct notes right enough when he's wearing a virtual headset. But maybe he doesn't have to wear it. It's just the driver that has to wear it, and the co-driver can just look. Yeah. So that would we've worked it out. It would work. I think that could be a massive benefit.
Another problem solved.
Already more abstract.
Another problem solved by Dirtfish. By Dirtfish.
No. By Jordan, you take all of the credit for that.
Oh well, it's only you guys that keep me going.
George, do you need to answer that call? Somebody's very keen to talk to you.
No, I don't.
Are you sure?
I know that they're driving for a couple of hours, so I keep sending them "I can't speak now" message, and they keep recalling me.
Okay, James, I know you. Maybe it's the and you had some questions.
George, let me ask you: if you were running one of these modern Monte Carlo tests, you've got one day to try and figure out what exactly you need to test in your car, what you want from it. How are you approaching that one day, trying to get a car that's going to work in all conditions that we don't know exactly what those conditions are going to be?
The general question is deferred to fabulous engineers. So that's they will decide how the program is done. Yes, a lot of people will have an input. Your lead engineer, your chief engineer, will already have all the hard work on figuring out what we need to test, how we should do it, etc. But it's the what to target. So that these days is done very mechanically and very, very thoroughly using weather records and weather forecasts to figure out, well, OK, it's looking like it's just going to be wet, so all we're going to be able to test is wet. We'll bank on that, we'll test the car for wet, and we will have to make a contingency set up for snow and for dry asphalt. But in a day, how do you get multiple conditions in a day? Well, you might get it. If you choose your test road really cleverly, you can maybe get it. But judging by the comments we've seen the last few years, nobody gets it. Mm. So it's just a question of knowing your car, categorically, engineers, having the drivers completely on board with what you're doing so that they are happy and they understand the drive. That's the biggest thing of all you can do these days, is make sure that everybody is absolutely directed off the same play card. You know, the game card has to be the same. Everyone has to understand the value and the direction of what we do so that nobody's feeling like they're starting behind the eight ball. And I say that with all our listeners will undoubtedly listen to WRC all the time, and you hear drivers telling you, Thierry's my favourite because he's always saying, oh, we didn't have a good test, we didn't get the right conditions. Well, yeah, but actually, you will have had conditions that would have given you a brilliant test in this, so you've got to bracket off that using your knowledge. And he's got now 8 years in Hyundai. It's 8 years he's got in Hyundai,
ten,
or is it
10
nine?
Years. And he's just
10 years, my goodness. So he's got a wealth of experience at that factory level. He should know how to balance and direct a car left and right. I think he's possibly a little bit lacking in that in terms of how he approaches it. I mean, certainly not lacking in any driving school. Anybody that listens knows my opinion of Terry is very high. But he does seem to get quite easily unsettled by that. Whereas Kalle Rovanperä, Seb Ogier, they don't get upset by that. They just deal with it.
I'm Kellen Koschel, and I just did my first Dirtfish course, which was the one-day women's course. My biggest surprise was how calm it could be in the car, and the calmer I was, the faster I could make the car go. The surprising thing about driving was that it wasn't necessarily a mental thing. I had to really get out of my head and into my body more, and I just felt a little more comfortable doing that for the first time around a group of women. But I will say, I do feel like I could do any of the Dirtfish courses now. I kind of know what to expect, and you know, hopefully more women get into motorsports, and then any day could be an all-women's day if just enough of us are in the sport. If I were talking to someone who was thinking about taking a class but was kind of on the fence, it would be, you know, what are you waiting for? It's such a fun experience. You're going to really learn something and you're going to push your limits and maybe you'll even have some more confidence.
There is significant change in the way that testing plays out now. And one day is, for me, with Monty, it does seem really difficult to test all of the surfaces, all of the conditions that you're going to get. And actually, it's impossible. You know, the one thing that some of the teams do is look for a low road in the morning, perhaps, where you could get rain or sunshine, but you're not going to get so much snow and ice. And then, excuse me, obviously move to a higher altitude, potentially even on the same road, and essentially just go further up the mountain in the afternoon where you can get snow and ice. But, you know, George, the teams, they do have, okay, it's the cars evolve year on year, but they do have a big bank of data, don't they? You look at a team like M Sport, they've been doing Monte Carlo since, well, certainly since 97, as the factory Ford team. But going back, you know, Malcolm Wilson was there in the 80s with a 6R4. These teams have a huge amount of knowledge, don't they? And
they do.
They can call on that.
Yeah, and M Sport certainly did on their debut with the Puma. They won.
Yeah. Mm. No, exactly.
And what was it? Seb Loeb had done hardly any testing in that car at all.
Well, he'd literally come from Dakar.
He made no changes to the setup at all.
And that, you know, for me, moving now onto drivers, you know, we've seen down the years that drivers can make a difference. And Sebastian Ogier is obviously looking, chasing his 10th win in Monte Carlo, which is just a phenomenal achievement. If, you know, 9 wins is record-breaking, but 10 would be quite extraordinary. The one that kind of sort of surprised me, I don't know if surprised is the right word, George, is the number that, I mean, Tommy did 4 straight, didn't he?
He did,
And that, you know, Monty would never... Tommy McKinnon had that same kind of aura and that same kind of reputation, if you like, as Colin McRae, that, you know, he had a lot of wins, not so many second places. How did you tune that Tommy kind of mentality into becoming a Monty winner?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I certainly can't take any credit in that at all. I was there for 2 of Tommy's Monte Carlo wins, so that was an absolute privilege. The last one with Mitsubishi and the first one, well, the one with Subaru. So that was
the one that Sebastian Loeb won. Really, is that the one?
No. Sebastian Loeb didn't win it. He had a 10-minute penalty.
Who got him that penalty, George?
Yeah, that was a very wily team manager got him that one actually. Honestly, talk about Sherlock Holmes, but that was. I mean, in terms of not overly proud of the fact that I did it in some ways, but you know, because Seb's such a lovely guy, but Seb never had any problem forgiving me for that. He understood. You've got to stay alert to.
But that was
Monte Carlo. Just to jump in,
George. I'm sorry, we've got to quantify that Seb did indeed forgive you, because actually you flew down to meet him in, where was it, Nice, and you offered him millions and millions and millions of pounds to come and drive for Subaru. So
yeah, it was actually his hometown.
Was it?
We flew down to his hometown.
Another great story. So yeah, I would forgive you if you offered me millions and millions of pounds.
Yeah, exactly. No, but he'd forgiven me long before that, because he's just such a fabulous guy.
So back to Tommy and Monty.
I mean, it was certainly not personal. Tommy and Monty. I mean, Tommy, David Lapworth described it very well, said that Tommy's basically got built-in anti-skid control. You know, he's got traction control built into his body. His right foot was so sensitive. He could take where Tommy always won the Monte Carlo rally was on the stages that were tricky, that are icy and horrible, and it was a big call on what to do for tyres, and Tommy always took a bold tyre choice, and he nearly always got through 30 seconds quicker than anyone else or 40 seconds quicker than anyone else. So it was pretty special what he could do.
It does.
Pretty spectacular, I think.
It does demand a certain sort of driver. Again, you look at someone like Valter Roll, who just was a great thinker, wasn't he? And, you know, it's no surprise that he had a great Monty record.
Tommy's nous for understanding tyres, options, and then how to drive those was, I think, second to none that I worked with. He was absolutely supreme on that. Very, very clever like that. Didn't always make the best tactical decisions at times, which was evidenced in his loss of the championship in 2001, because he basically needed to do was score something like, was it 8 points in the latter half of the year, and he didn't manage to do that. He kept trying to win events. If he'd finished 2 second places, he would have been champion, and he was incapable of doing that. Three thirds, he didn't manage to do that. He just kept throwing it off. They were all trying to win events at that time. You know, it was Richard, it was Colin, Tommy, Juha was still around, Carlos, of course. So everybody was just trying to win. It was just an absolute flat-out blast. Tactics were something that were boring and uninteresting. Those guys just like to drive fast, evidenced by Colin's spectacular career.
And George, just going back to you talking about Tommy being very intelligent with his tyre choices, how did the choices that drivers had differ back then to what we've got now? Because obviously we've got limited choices now, but back then a lot more flexibility.
You had a massive choice of tyres by comparison. I mean, I remember those first Monte Carlos we went to, each service van had a 10-ton tyre truck with us. which was three quarters filled with tyres. So we'd have three rally cars, and we would have three or four different types of slicks. We'd even have micro-grooved slicks, so they basically sliced them with a razor. They looked like a slick, but when you turned a corner, it would move and give some grip. They were all sliced like that. Then you had wets, intermediates, snow tires, ice tires, much softer. And then you had the slicks. You had slicks that were ice slicks. They were unbelievably soft. I mean, you could maybe have a choice of 10 tires at any one stage.
And they had.
And that was 10 tires for three cars. A choice, you would change every stage.
I remember, George, as well. Wow. There were in terms of the studs. Even when I was covering the Monte,
half studded, full studded.
But then you could have studs on the inside shoulder, the outside shoulder.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, all those things. Yeah, you'd put them on the inside shoulder if there's just some icy bits. Mm. So when there's no traction, the inside stud will get a grip. But when you start to push it, the tyre shoulders over and you get the grip from the outside. Yeah, it was great technology, a fantastic time. But, you know, you would probably, I mean, I'm not sure what the numbers were, but I would imagine you could have easily have 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 tyres for one team.
Yeah. Yeah, you would need to, wouldn't you? Yeah. Just to, you know, in case conditions went in one direction.
So we would have 6 or 7, maybe even 8 service groups on Monte Carlo, because you're servicing before and after every stage. So obviously after the stage it might just be an emergency service, depending on, but sometimes you would have your main service there, and then you would just drive to the start and have a fuel top off and whatever, just depended on the length of the road sections.
Did you use helicopters, George?
You would warm. We never used helicopters at that time. I think Lancia did, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s. We didn't. There's nowhere to land in Monte Carlo. You know, you're at the side of the road. You're just on a cliff, basically.
Yeah, I can.
There wasn't a lot of option.
I can definitely tell you that there was only ever one journalist who would have been at the end of every stage, and one journalist who could keep across every single tyre choice to the absolute nth degree without fail, and that was Mr. David Williams. He absolutely adored the Monte Carlo Rally. He always preferred tarmac rallies anyway. Not that he would ever admit to it. But it was just the whole aura of the thing. It has such a mystique.
It was an amazing experience, and it still is the event where a smart team will win. Great driver, yes, but a smart team, a team giving the driver all the opportunities, all the right information. What does the driver want and need? He's a driver that's really, really clever with tyres. So he really needs great ground information. You know, he needs ground temperatures. We need ground conditions. You don't need to throw tyre crews in there or weather crews in there willy-nilly. You need intelligent people that understand what they're doing. I've been in teams that had many tyre crews that were some of them mediocre. Sometimes they were giving you reports they weren't even in the right place, to be honest. It was very disappointing.
But that is, for me, that is where someone like Ogier really scores. You know, he was born and brought up in the mountains, and he understands the weather. You know, he worked as a ski instructor. We all know that. And it does bring an understanding of what the weather's doing, doesn't it? In, you know, if the wind is coming from this direction, you know that on that road it's going to equate to this, and this. And if there's some moisture there by 10 o'clock in the morning when the sun's kind of come up, yeah, you can guarantee that that will have melted or all of that sort of
absolutely
stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know,
I mean, there's basic stuff that some teams still seem to miss that shocks me, David. You know, the fact is that, you know, the temperature is still going down. The roads are still starting to freeze up until 1 hour after sunrise. Only then does the temperature start to level out and come the other way. Mm-hmm. So you've got gravel crews, weather crews looking at a stage thinking, well, that's still just water. So, and the sun's come up, so they go away and they do another bit and they do another bit. And they report back that, you know, at kilometre 6.7 to 8.3, a bit that's known to be quite bad. No, it was just water. And their road temperature, you know, they put a temperature gauge down on it. And they say, it's 3 degrees. Everyone thinks fine. Mm. And then by 9 o'clock, it's frozen solid and they're away to the next place.
Yeah,
you know, they've gone that early to make tire choices based on that, and they've not got charts and they've not got nice. I used to have road drying indexes, road cooling indexes, all sorts of good stuff. That's things that I did. These days, it's all done by engineers. I was a team manager and I did that.
Was that because you wanted to do that, George, or because you didn't? Trust people to. But it sounds very alley.
I wanted to, but it was all part of the competitive element. So I was not driven by any personal desire. I was driven by the team's needs. Basically, what the co-drivers are telling me the drivers want, you know.
Yeah.
Drivers are usually talking to engineers. I'm not really necessarily talking to a team manager so much because I don't give them so much. But on Monte Carlo, Carlos, Didier, Juha, these guys, they did lean to Tommy. They did lean into you because you're giving them, you know, I want to get this and these are the reasons I want to get. Yes, do that, George. But also, not that call, do the next call because it's always worse than that one. So we know if that one's away, that first one will be away. So that's the sort of information I gathered. And I would go out and I would do a service recce and then I would have my crews going to those points, personally briefed, made sure they had the map. At some points, depending on the team I was in, I actually had little clues. Cause I said, can you take me a photograph of such and such and then send me it? Oh, I've not got such a good connection. What does the road sign? Are you standing at that junction? Yeah, what does the road sign say? And then you find out that they can't tell you. Yeah, you're not in the right place, so stop telling me drivel. You know,
you could never pull the wall over George Donaldson's eyes.
Oh, you can actually imagine. But I've had it pulled over, which is why I tried to prevent it later. But that's what you're up against, and that's what will scupper a team.
Yeah.
You know, someone's mate's brought along because they think it's a jolly, and oh, he's a great guy, and actually never gets to the right place.
Yeah. No, it's hopeless. It's remarkable. But great stories, and thank you very much. And more of those to come as we get closer to Monte Carlo next week, or not next week, the week after, but on next week's pod. But one thing, James, that we can't ignore is Dakar. It is up and running, started with a prologue on Friday. We're a couple of days in, or 3 days in, as people listening to this pod. Just James, give us a brief outline. You've written a brilliant preview to the event on dirtfish.com, but just what's this year's event all about? Where are we going, and who should people be looking out for as the event continues to unfold?
Well, we're back in Saudi Arabia, David. I think it's the fifth edition of Dakar in Saudi now, so we sort of know what to expect. We know the terrain, we know the conditions, but this year there's a few things that really should make it an absolute all-time classic, and probably the biggest thing is just the number of factory supported teams involved. You know, we've got the big news of Ford M Sport at Dakar in there. Is it the Raptor or the Ranger? I think it's the
Ranger. Ranger.
It's a truck. I know that much. A factory supported effort there for Ford. So it'll be their first effort. So I don't think they're expecting to challenge for victory. It'll be a tough event for them, but just fantastic to see, you know, Ford back supporting, rallying, albeit in a different way to the kind of used to. The big favourites will probably be Nasser Al-Attiyah, but he's moved teams this year, so he's long been a Toyota driver, but he's now moved over to the ProDrive effort ahead of actually moving again to Dacia next year, albeit. We believe that under the skin, that car will be fairly similar to what he'll be driving this year. So Nasser Al-Attiyah has won the event for the last few years, but his teammate Sebastian Loeb has been trying to win Dakar now for almost a decade, and he hasn't done it. And there's not many events which Sebastian Loeb has entered nearly 10 times and failed to win. So he's absolutely desperate to finally get Dakar on his very long and illustrious CV. Can't count out Mr. Dakar, Stefan Peterhansel. The Audi effort, which will be in its last year, I believe, this year, hasn't been particularly successful. They've had a few gremlins in their efforts for the last two seasons, but they have had the speed to win stages. Of course, his teammate's Carlos Sainz, who's, you know, any WRC fan will be excited to see how he gets on. He's won it a couple of times. Toyota are back. They've got five drivers in their Hiluxes. Very South African bias, obviously that team being run out of South Africa, but it's amazing to see just how many South African drivers there are in Rally Raid. It's a real cultural thing in that country. And they've also got the Brazilian Lucas Moraes, who finished third last year in his debut, and he's been promoted to a factory driver for Toyota. So basically, long story short, there's a huge amount of contenders involved, and you know, we're not going to know who's going to win, you know, till a couple of weeks' time, because anything can happen on the Dakar. It's tremendously exciting. It's 5,000 miles across Saudi Arabia. 3,000 of those are competitive stage miles.
It's a monster, isn't it?
Test.
It really is. But one man who does know that monster from the inside is our man Colin Clark, and we can just say a quick hello to Colt. Colt, you are in the field.
Well, at this precise moment, I'm not actually in the field. I'm in the media center, which is a big tent. It's not the biggest tent, because the biggest tent is the catering tent, but the media center is a big tent. The impressive thing, though, David, is the number, and George and James, is the number of folk in this media center. It's absolutely buzzing. It really is. But I have been out in the field. I was out this morning to watch the start of the prologue, and it's just spectacular. You've been in this part of the world, David. It is a spectacular part of the world, and you know, to see such a variety of cars and bikes and trucks and buggies heading off into this spectacular landscape here. It was wonderful, and I'm really quite enjoying it, even although I'm sleeping in a tent, even although I'm having to use the communal showers and bathrooms. It's still a magnificent experience, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
You will never complain about...
did I ever complain in the past? But
yes.
You're quite right, I never...
I actually thought that Colin was responsible for everything in terms of accommodation.
There's been a couple of times we've had to share a shower between two of us, and that was too much, so you're doing very well.
Well, I would object to that too.
No, I'm not objecting to it. I'm not objecting to it at all. You just very quickly just get on with it. You get on with it, and you make use of what's there. And I have to say, they do a great job in providing showers and things and keeping them nice and clean and tidy as much as they can. When you've got 2,500 people, you know, in the desert getting covered in sand and getting covered in dust every day.
I will just take you back to Finland last year, Cole, when there was a consistent amount of moaning, "Oh, I can't believe we've only got one toilet. I can't believe that." Does that sound familiar? Ringing any bells there? Yeah, I thought
so.
Yeah,
maybe, David, thank you.
So just very quickly, tell us about your own tent. How big is it?
Yeah, listen, last year I made the mistake of going for a really high-tech tent, but it was just too small. I couldn't even fit my bag in it. I had to sleep in the tent, and my bag had to live outside of the tent. So this year I've gone for a bigger tent. So what I've compromised time. So it takes me a little longer to put it up, but there's loads of space inside. I've even got a porch that I can just shutter off as well. So takes me longer to put it up, to take it down, but I have a lot more comfort when it is up. So I've got that, but I've had remarkable tent envy once again as I've wandered around the bivouac, and the Pro Drive setup with their bivvy tents. Anyone listening in Australia will understand what I'm talking about when I talk about a bivvy tent. It's basically off the ground. It's a fantastic mattress with a tent over the top of it. They have offered me one of their bivvy tents for the rest of the event. So I am taking that offer up very, very, very kindly indeed.
That's very nice. And how's the weather? Is it raining?
No, it rained a lot last year, didn't it? It absolutely chucked it down, and we had a lot of mud and horrible weather and floods last year. It's been gorgeous. Not a cloud in the sky. I think you'd have just about survived, David. 23, 24 degrees. Very, very pleasant. Too hot for you?
Far, far too warm.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Oh, dear. Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. But it's been very pleasant. It really has. It'll get warmer as we go down towards the empty quarter, towards the middle of next week, maybe up into the 30s, but it's a nice time of the year to come out here and to rally here. You couldn't rally here. Once you get into end of March, April, May, and then the summer, it would just be way, way too hot. But right now, it's very, very pleasant. And do you know what else is pleasant? From a rally perspective, so many familiar faces with M Sport here now. You know, David Richards, in the catering tent, this enormous, it's the biggest tent in the world. I've never seen a tent as big as it. And they do an incredible job.
It's surely a marquee, not a tent.
Yeah, but it's not even a marquee. Marquee doesn't do it justice. I don't know what we should call it.
O2 Arena for those of us in
yes.
The...
Yes, you could probably do a concert in there and maybe have an audience of 5,000 people. It's that big.
Wow.
It's that big.
Wow.
It really is. But maybe not quite that big. But I walked in today and it's absolutely heaving. It's a great place. The atmosphere is always great. Loads of people chattering away. Loads of people just laughing and having a bit of fun and something to eat in the catering tent. And I walked in. And there was David Richards with his wife. And there was Malcolm Wilson with Elaine Wilson. And they were greeting each other. And I thought, wow, you know, that is proper rally royalty. And everywhere you look, you know, there are rally people here. You know, from the drivers to the mechanics, the engineers, the team bosses. It's a very, very, although unfamiliar place for me, certainly, it is also a very, very familiar place with all the familiar faces and voices around the bivouac. And I'm just about getting used to calling it a bivouac.
Yeah. Excellent, yeah. Colin. You're entering into the spirit.
Don't be coming to Gap and calling Gap a bivouac, will you?
Well, David, you have permission to slap me if I call it the bivvy.
Regularly.
Can you stretch to me coming to Monte Carlo? Because I really want to slap Colin.
No, exactly. Right, Colt, we'll let you go. Go and put your tent up or take it down or whatever you're about to do. And thank you very much and enjoy.
Yes, I will. Thanks, boys. I will keep you up to date with what's going on. It is a lot of fun. It really
standing
is.
So, by here, thanks, Colin. Boys.
Thanks,
have
Colin.
Fun on the pod, and we'll talk to you all later.
See you, mate. We will keep in touch with Colin across the next 10 days or so as he continues to live out of a tent. And, chaps, thank you very much, George. Brilliant insight, as usual, as ever. Can't wait for next week and more of the same. And, James, again, brilliant questions. And we will reconvene for another edition of Spin the Rally Pod next week.